White European men in togas engaging in orgies or watching gladiators fight to bloody deaths. Emperor Nero playing the fiddle while Rome burns. Roman characters speaking in British accents. So much of our perception of ancient Rome comes from films that perpetuate stereotypes and misconceptions. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest today focuses her career on upending myths about ancient Rome and showing us how this complex civilization had far more diversity and cultural relevance than we may think. Nandini Pandey is a UW-Madison professor of classical and ancient Near Eastern studies, and her first book was entitled The Poetics of Power in Augustan Rome. Her second book is Empire of Difference, What the Romans Can Teach Us About Diversity. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
It's really a fascinating topic, and I'm curious about your own journey to that area of study.
Yeah, thanks so much for asking. I think literature and the study of antiquity are both forms of traveling across time and space. And I think as a child of immigrants myself, I had a lot of experience translating across cultures. I remember never feeling like I quite fit in with my American classmates when I was in elementary school. I always felt a little different. I looked different. I grew up in a suburb of New York. But my parents were both Indian, but they spoke different languages. So our language at home was English. And I always felt a little bit out of place when we would go back to India. I felt like a foreigner there too. So I think the sense of double displacement was what led me to really seek a kind of chosen family within books. So I loved reading and I read voraciously. I read everything I could get my hands on, from C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien when I was really little to Shakespeare and Joyce. And somewhere along the line, I decided that I couldn't understand great English authors without understanding where they'd come from, which is what led me to the study of Latin. I did not go to a richer privileged school. I did not have an opportunity to take Latin in my secondary education. But when I got to college, the first class I signed up for was a Latin class, and it was absolutely life-changing. Just the first sound of Latin that I heard when my professor walked into the room on the first day was enough to make me really fall in love with Latin, and I've kept going and never looked back.
I saw that sometimes when you're teaching or writing about ancient Rome, you'll drop in a clip from Monty Python. And, you know,
right.
When you're talking about learning Latin, I'm wondering if we can listen to that short clip that is so funny, where, you know, it has to do with grammar in Latin.
Absolutely.
What's this then? Romanes eunt domus. People call Romanes, they go the house.
It says Romans go home.
No, it doesn't. What's Latin for Roman? Come on, come on.
Romanus?
Goes like.
Annus?
Vocative plural of Annus is.
Anni?
Romani. Aunt? What is aunt?
Go.
Conjugate the verb to go.
Here, eo is it imus idis aunt.
So aunt is?
Third person plural, present indicative. They go.
But Romans go home is an order, so you must use the...
imperative.
Which is? How many Romans?
Ite.
Ite. Domus. Nominative. Go home. This is motion towards, isn't it, boy?
Dative. Dative. No. The accusative. Accusative. Domum. Domum.
Except the comma takes the...
The locative.
Which is...
Domum.
Domum. Understand?
Yes, sir.
Now, write out 100 times.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Hail Caesar, sir.
Hail Caesar.
That's hilarious, but tell me what you hear in that as a classics professor who works on ancient Rome. What do you hear?
Well, anyone who has ever been in a Latin classroom will find that scene uncomfortably familiar. So it's a hilarious little exercise in Latin grammar, but it also contains a lot of interesting assumptions and stereotypes that accompany classics and Latin teaching. I have to admit, I was a kid that loved science and math, and I was always really good at physics, and I liked logic and analytics. So for me, the study of Latin was fascinating precisely because it was extremely rigorous. You have to know all the endings of all these words to use in an appropriate context. But the thing I love about that is that makes a sentence sort of feel like a puzzle that has to fit perfectly together. So there's something very endearing, I think, about watching this centurion walk this poor unsuspecting graffiti artist through that aspect of Latin grammar. On the other hand, it's really interesting to see the power dynamics that are going on within that clip. And I've written an article about that for the online journal Eidolon. In fact, I took the name of my column that I write for them from the quote, "Romans go home." And it's interesting to me how, in the end, the result of this centurion having this poor rebel write the graffiti over and over again on the walls is actually just kind of reinscribing this message of rebellion, right? So there's an authority that's fighting against a rebel, but they're both using the same language to construct a sort of set of different ideas.
And you hear, of course, the British accents.
Right.
Can you talk about our assumptions about the ancient Romans when what we hear often are people speaking in what really sounds like they should be doing Shakespeare or something?
That's right. And it's fascinating how cinematic depictions of Rome always have very posh British guys with plummy received accents doing the job of being Rome. And I think there's a sort of false mapping on that we tend to do as modern audiences of the British Empire onto the Roman Empire, when in reality, the Roman Empire was actually much more diverse in some ways and more inclusive, and people from all sorts of parts of empire could all rise up through the ranks and become these guys in charge. So I think that it's I think that Monty Python trades on that. I think they're actually very smart and very knowing, but there's a certain nostalgia for the good old days of the British Empire, where Queen Victoria and her troops governed and kept order amongst the unruly provinces, which is actually quite different than the way power worked in this era. So I'll play the clip.
They take everything we had, and not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labor the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct?
What?
The aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation.
Medicine. Mm-hmm. Education. Oh, yeah. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we'd really miss, Reg, if the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system, and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
So what would you add to that question, what have the Romans ever done for us?
So a lot of the clip is actually really correct in enumerating all of the benefits that the Romans brought to the places that they conquered. However, one thing it doesn't get right is that the people they conquered were actually... There was never any evidence for any racism or any discrimination in the legal codes here. The Romans were actually pretty hands-off culturally, so they often let people maintain their traditions, their beliefs, even their coin systems in some cases, certainly their local languages that they spoke at home. The Romans were so successful at maintaining empire for so long because they were actually very hands-off and allowed local cultures to continue to thrive. So the movie is really interested in this one rebellious group of Jews. That's a People's Front of Judea, I believe it's called. In the movie, there's a joke because there's a number of different groups, and it's sort of imitating all the fighting that's happening in modern-day Palestine. But in reality, there actually was not a huge amount of Roman persecution of minorities. In fact, the Romans were very inclusive and tended to really adopt local religions and adopt local people and provide them with opportunities that they might not have had if they were in their isolated little states in a warring Mediterranean. They did bring peace and a lot of chances of cultural exchange and exchange of ideas and chances to move around and to trade and to gain education. So there's a lot that Rome really did get right, and it got right the fact that it was able to assimilate a lot of people and include them in this project rather than govern from the top down as the British tended to do in India or Israel or these modern nations.
The way Rome is often taught in school, it comes, after ancient Greece, and then you go to ancient Rome, and it basically looks like they just steal. They steal the myths and just give them new names. They steal lots of ideas. So explain that sort of phenomenon where it looks as if their approach to civilizations before them is theft.
Well, I think that's absolutely one way you could look at it. You could call it theft. You could call it imitation, being a high form of flattery. Certainly the Romans were great at adapting and adopting the traditions and customs and beliefs that they thought were useful. So it was a form of stealing, but it was a really pragmatic form that meant that they had a lot of respect for, say, the gods of local cultures that they conquered. A lot of the Roman pantheon is actually borrowed or stolen or migrant gods, even from the 4th century BC. They had a practice called evocatio, of inviting the god of a local city to come over to the Roman side and be worshipped in Rome. And that was one way that they thought of getting all the gods on their side so that the gods would help their cause. So it's they thought of it as a process of invitation and adaption. They were trying to take the best ideas from where they could. And I think there's something really refreshing about that compared to modern ideologies of cultural superiority, where people think that they have it the right way and everyone else has to have it their way. Don't get me wrong, the Romans did have certain lines that couldn't be crossed. So the problem that they had with the monotheistic religions of Judaism and Christianity was that those religions did not have reciprocity. They could certainly adopt those religions' gods, but the fact that they refused to, that Christians and Jews refused to worship the Roman state gods was seen as deeply threatening and almost treasonous. So they were actually quite tolerant, and the only place that they really showed dramatic intolerance is against people that they thought to be intolerant themselves.
Well, one of the ways that Romans are portrayed in films is, you know, bloodthirsty, spectators of gladiators, very violent. That seems to be a bit contrary to this notion of, spreading peace.
Well, and that's part of what I get into in my book. I think that we can't take a simple message from Rome and apply it to the modern U.S. The Romans did a lot of things really well, and they did a lot of things really badly when it came to inclusion. The fact that they were very colorblind in their legal system, and they provided real opportunities for emancipation and for ascent through the social ranks, is one thing that's really positive that we can take away from Rome. On the other side, and I really want to emphasize this to your viewers, or your readers, rather, the Romans' society was fundamentally founded on violence and slavery and exploitation. And the Roman Empire was a machine that caused a lot of interaction between people and ideas, but it also was fundamentally based on exploitation and on a lot of human trafficking. So the reason why Rome, for instance, became a hugely diverse city was because a lot of people were initially brought into the city as slaves. They were people that were considered to be property. Oddly, though, the Romans, unlike any other nation that had existed before, once they freed slaves, which they did with surprising regularity, they would actually make those freed slaves full citizens. So they had a way of sharing wealth and enfranchisement and civic rights, which is quite shocking given that a person could go from the status of property one day to the status of a citizen the next day. So there's some things that we can still take away, even though I'm certainly not advocating the kind of violence and exploitation that we see in Roman society.
So can you give us a sense, first of all, of the dates that you're talking about, and also who are these people? You said that the Roman Empire in some ways was colorblind, and that people brought in from different places, once they were freed, could rise through the ranks. Can you give us a sense, first of all, the dates we're talking about, and also people from where? What kinds of people fell into this?
Yeah, I mean, and one of the interesting things about this project is I really wanted to focus on the kind of golden day of the Roman Empire, so basically what's referred to as the Principate, so about 31 BC when Augustus takes over and starts an empire, to maybe the late 200 CE. But as I have been working on this project, I find that the time borders start expanding a lot. For one, the Romans' stories that they told themselves about their earliest origins really are all about multiculturalism and cultural blending. So the famous epic that Virgil wrote about Aeneas, who is an ancestor of the Julian clan that gave us the Emperor Augustus. In that story, Aeneas is actually a refugee from Troy, a city in the province of Asia. And he is displaced from his home by war. He travels across the Mediterranean. Mediterranean in a way that really actually reminds me very much of the immigration crisis that we're seeing right now in Europe. But when he gets to Italy, there is local conflict because the goddess Juno is kind of jealous of the Trojans. She doesn't want them to settle in. But ultimately, after there's some fighting between the Trojans and the Italians, she consents for them to intermarry and to blend cultures so thoroughly that the Trojans sort of fade away and they become wholly united with the Italians. So that story is supposedly set probably around 1100 BC, but that creates a backstory where the story of Rome is always one of cultural mixing. Then around the same era as Virgil was writing, this is actually in the age of Augustus, a historian called Livy told another famous story about Roman foundation, the story of Romulus and Remus. And there's lots of violent parts of this story, too. You know, this is a running theme in Roman history. But after Romulus murdered his brother to found his city, he found that he needed people to populate it. So what he did was throw open the doors of his new city to people from all over Italy. And he invited anyone, even criminals who were seeking asylum, to come and to live in his city. So they're already a kind of huge cultural mix because Italy was actually composed of many different tribes. It was not a unified entity. And in fact, Italy has always had a problem becoming unified, as we can see even in the modern country. So they attract all these men from all over the place. And then they need wives. So they actually steal wives from the Sabine tribe, which lives nearby. And these women come over. Their fathers and their brothers from home come to try to take them back. And they actually serve this really important function in helping to integrate their newly Roman husbands with their Sabine families. And so even in that early story of Rome set around 753 BC, we find that the idea that you should intermarry, intermingle with other people and be open to other people is really at the very foundations of Rome. So I'm going quite far backwards in terms of my time period. Rome began as a small little city on the Tiber with no particular recommendations, but it slowly conquered all of its neighboring people, various tribes like the Etruscans, the Oscans, the Sabines. It slowly took over a lot of Italy and then began to expand throughout the Mediterranean. But what it did was integrate the people that lived in these spaces into Roman society so that we find that some of the best advocates of Roman diversity are actually people from the conquered East, people like the Greek historian Polybius or Dionysius of Halicarnassus. So it was quite inclusive. And even on the later end, a lot of the authors we think of as quintessentially Roman, like Augustine or Apuleius, were actually from North Africa. So I think we don't emphasize in our classics curriculum how multicultural our authors are. I think that people tend to assume by default that they were all white, speaking with British accents.
Right.
But in fact, I mean, many of them were of all colors, and there's plenty of people from Asia, people from Africa, people from the North.
I was going to ask you about Roman concepts of race and color, and we'll do that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Nandini Pandey, and our topic is diversity in ancient Rome. You, in some of the columns that you've written and articles and in the your book projects, have talked about race in ancient Rome. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what that meant to them. Did they see themselves as being from different races? Did they have a hierarchy the way so often in the modern world we have had to destructive ends,
right,
had concepts of race that have a hierarchy? What did the Romans think about skin color?
That's a great question. And one thing that is so fascinating about looking back to the Romans is they were a society that existed before the advent of modern concepts of race and modern concepts of racism. The ideas that we have about race unfortunately date to an era around the Enlightenment, where people were really invested in trying to find objective proofs that certain races were superior than others. But we know now through modern science and genetics that actually members of a given race might actually be more diverse from one another genetically than they are from people outside that supposed race, right? So the very idea of race, as I'm sure your listeners will realize, is very much a social construct. It's interesting to look back at Rome because they did have ideas of ethnic difference. They certainly understood there were different skin colors and different cultures that people came from. But for the most part, they had a sense of environment and culture playing a huge role in making people who they were. So they have some beliefs that will sound really funny to us, but back in the day, this was science. They thought that climates would cause certain characteristics to reveal themselves more. So if you were in the north, when it was cold, your blood would be kind of thicker, so you would be likely to be braver, but also more stupid is one stereotype that they had. If you were from the south, you might be smarter, but maybe less courageous in battle. They had certain stereotypes. But the thing that's really interesting is that they basically thought that all humans were fundamentally the same. And it was where you happened to be born and the culture that you happened to grow up with that shaped how you turned out. So the really interesting thing about this environmental idea of ethnic difference is that they thought that once you transplanted someone from one environment to another, they would adapt according to that environment. They thought, it will not surprise you, that Italy was the best of all possible environments.
Of course.
Everyone feels comfortable with their home culture and climate. But they actually thought that one thing that made Italy great was that Italy was able to nurture and be a home and foster parent to people from all over the world. So rather than talking about building walls and keeping people out, they actually wanted to bring people in because they thought people would really thrive in this environment.
Because they would change and be more like the other people in Rome?
They thought that Italy was really temperate, so it brought out good intellectual and physical qualities, and they thought it was just a very healthful, nurturing environment for different people. So it's interesting. There's a few passages from various authors, including Pliny, where you see a sort of the praises of Italy. Virgil has a version of this too. And they talk about how there's so much natural bounty. Everything thrives. And the period that I work in, and my first book was about the age of Augustus, in this period, you find a lot of natural and vegetal imagery in the art of this age. And I think that that's a sense that that reflects a sense that Italy was a place where all creatures, including all humans, could really flourish.
What about concepts of beauty? Because sometimes attitudes show up that way, where certain kinds of appearance are valued more. You know, or you have women trying to have smaller noses or, you know, whiter skin or straighten their hair or do certain things. Is there anything when you look at kind of evidence of concepts of beauty that tells you anything?
I'm so glad you asked that question because there's actually a whole book of poetry. It's, in fact, three books of poetry by Ovid, one of my very favorite authors, called The Art of Love. And in this book, Ovid, he writes the first two books for men seeking women to hook up with in Rome. And the third book is actually advice for women about how to find a partner. It's a fascinating insight into standards of beauty. And what we find is actually that the Romans were really inclusive in those terms, too. So there is no part of Ovid's work that says, oh, you need to look for a fair-skinned person because that's the best. He actually has advice about where to find people from all over the place. So if you prefer pale-skinned women, or if you prefer dark-skinned women, here's where you go to look for them. For the women, when he gives fashion advice and cosmetic advice, he always is really balanced in the way he gives this advice. So he kind of goes through a list of all the different kinds of dye and cloth that are available in Rome, and he tells women that they should dress for their complexion. So if you happen to be pale, you can fix your paleness by using blush and by wearing dark colors. But if you happen to have a darker complexion, you will look great in white, and here are some other makeup tricks for you. Mm. So it's really fascinating that I think Ovid is incredibly inclusive in terms of the human variety of people that are there in Rome. There's something interestingly quite dehumanizing about Ovid because he's sort of lumping people together without making any differentiation amongst them. But it's a testament to how many kinds of people were in Rome, how many different looks there were on the street. And Ovid is clearly really thrilled with all the dating possibilities that this opens up to people in the city of Rome.
It's interesting. And if you think back to the tests that have been done with dolls and children where they're asked to choose, you know, the beautiful doll, where you have sometimes black children choosing a white doll. That was part of the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case, is looking at the damaging effects of certain attitudes. So you would guess, since we don't have the evidence, that if a doll test was given to children in ancient Rome, they wouldn't necessarily choose a fairer-skinned doll over a darker-skinned doll?
Yeah, I would guess so. I mean, I would imagine that they would choose the doll that looked like their parents or the people that were closest to them when they were young. But it's interesting because we can even see through Roman urban patterns that there wasn't really clustering of certain ethnic groups in neighborhoods. So it's quite different from modern America, where actually your zip code is a pretty high determinant of the people that you're going to be around, and even things like your life expectancy. In Rome, there were neighborhoods, but there were rich people living side by side with poor people, and there were people from all over the Roman world that would really be rubbing shoulders with one another every day. On top of that, I want to add that the Romans, we falsely believe sometimes that Roman statuary was all white, just white marble, and that actually has done a lot of damage in terms of giving historical authority to the conception that whiteness is beauty. But in actual fact, Roman statuary was brightly colored. People had skin tones. Nobody is actually white, maybe a few albinos, but everybody has a skin tone. And Roman art used to be brightly colored. There would be skin hues that would be depicted on these statues. And it
how
is
do
actually
you, how do we know that?
You can see this. You can still actually see remnants of paint on statues, and it was actually kind of an invention of the Renaissance when people were digging up statues from the ground and rediscovering Roman art. They were not invested in historically reconstructing the bright colored paint that used to be on these statues. They were trying to differentiate themselves from the Middle Ages, and they were trying to act like they were finding something new. It enhanced their own status if they could feel that they were bringing Rome back. Mm-hmm. So they didn't do the scientific research that we might do in a modern excavation team. And there's actually a really interesting trend in museum curation. And if you go to the city of Rome, there's places where they might do light shows where they project color onto statues that have lost their paint through the wear of time. But you can go and you can sometimes see like the Ara Pacis, the Altar of Peace, which is now looks like it was white marble, but actually it was painted. You can see them sometimes will project paint over this beautiful work of art and show it in its true colors, which were very bright and very vivid. So in a way, that's a metaphor for my project. I'm
sure.
Trying to color
put the color back in ancient Rome.
Exactly.
I saw that you'd written, I think, an article having to do with hair.
That's right. Yeah.
Why?
That is I was actually really inspired by a friend of mine. When I was in Baltimore, I met this wonderful lady named Janet Stevens, who is a hairdresser and happened to be sheltering in the Walters Art Museum once during a rainstorm, and was in the Roman Gallery and started getting really interested in how those elaborate hairdos that we see on female statues of Roman women were held together. So she got into experimental archaeology, trying to reconstruct Roman hairstyles. It's really interesting that you can kind of trace fashions that traveled through the Roman Empire, and often we can see that women were really interested in making themselves look more exotic. So I started looking into the idea of Roman hair, and I noticed that there was a thriving wig trade. People would actually really enjoy buying wigs of blonde wigs, especially coming from Germany, because that made them kind of stand out from the crowd and look different. What's interesting is that the Germans had just been conquered, so actually most Romans' experience of any German people, if they'd ever seen one, might have been as a sort of victim paraded in triumph through Rome. So I found it really interesting that women, very elite women who had money to spend, were sometimes spending it to try to look like the other that Rome had conquered. There was something really interesting to them about playing the other, and they literally would start looking exactly like a victim of Roman imperialism. If they were putting on a blonde head of hair, mm-hmm. a blonde wig, they were almost making themselves over in the image of Rome's conquered people. So that, again, kind of breaks down the assumptions that we might have about who's on top culturally and who's at the bottom. I think the Romans were really interested in learning more about other cultures and even sort of trying on other cultures. They would put on, for instance, British face paint, a blue face paint as a fashion statement. They were even sort of erotic collectors. So we have some evidence about women finding it interesting to sleep with men from Spain or from Syria. And there's a sort of adventurism sexually that we even find evidence for among Roman elites.
Well, let's talk more generally about the position of women mm-hmm. in ancient Rome. What can you tell us about that? Because, you know, the whole question of who gets to govern, how far can you go in life, how much freedom do you have, who owns property, who makes decisions. Give us sort of the prevailing thought now about what it was like to be a woman in ancient Rome.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would not want to be a woman in ancient Rome, but it was much better than being a woman in ancient Greece, I will tell you that. Roman women had a fair amount of legal power and social power compared to women in many other cultures in the ancient Mediterranean. They were able to exert a lot of control within a household. There were I don't want to get into the specifics of Roman law here, which is not my field of expertise, but they had a lot of power within families. And actually, interestingly, the rise of the emperors gave women in the imperial household a lot more power, because if you were the wife of an emperor or the daughter of an emperor, you might have a lot more power over their decision making. I will say that I have like a long, it's probably too long of a point, but sometimes I think that whenever we try to give people more equality, they're often unspoken losers. And you can think of the U.S. 14th Amendment, the so-called equal rights amendment. So the 14th Amendment gave rights to the newly freed slaves, but it's also the first place that specified male with regard to citizenship. And it was not until a long time later, in the 19th Amendment, that women got the right to vote. In Rome, too, I feel like women are sometimes the unspoken losers. As people gained equality, as slaves were manumitted, women still had many fewer rights than even a male citizen who was of a low class. And this is something that Ovid points out, that women have really very little protection against domestic violence. In most cases, they pass from being under the immediate legal guardianship of their father to the legal guardianship of their husbands when they get married. And so when we find Ovid, for instance, telling you how to date and find a lover within Rome, he's actually kind of enhancing the possibilities for women to be victimized. It looks like he's giving them more choice. You get to go out and pick the guy that you like and flirt with him and attract him. But really, this is a way for a woman to get a new master, to exchange her father for mm-hmm. a husband as a master. And if she acted without the consent of her father, that actually exposed her to a fair amount of punishment. So we see this happen with the Emperor Augustus's own daughter and granddaughter. They were both called Julia, and they both got in trouble for having adulterous affairs. And because Augustus was their he had the rights of the pater familias over his family, he was able to exile them both. And his anger with them actually extended even beyond the grave. He refused to allow them to be buried in his own mausoleum. Oh. So so even though the Romans were very inclusive culturally, it doesn't mean that everybody had rights in Roman society. And I do want to underline again that the big driver of diversity was to a great degree the importation of slaves as humans into urban centers, where eventually they might be freed if they were well positioned, if they happened to have an elite job in an elite household. They might have a chance at freedom. But there were also very many slaves who didn't leave that much of a mark in the historical record, who might have been laboring anonymously in fields, who would never really have a chance at manumission. So I think it's important to underline that, too.
What was the prevailing attitude towards sexual orientation and difference? Because that's another form of diversity.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what kinds of attitudes there were.
Yeah. I mean, it's not my field of expertise, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say, but they were much more open sexually than we tend to be as a society, sometimes in ways that we might find very creepy and disturbing, given that once someone was a slave, they were available for the use of their master, and that includes sexual uses. So a recent visitor to Madison named Amy Richland has done some really interesting work on this subject and talks about a huge trade in, like, young children from Egypt were imported in huge quantities into the city of Rome to basically serve as the playthings of elite people. So they didn't have that really strong divide between gay and straight that we tend to have in our culture. I think sexuality was more fluid. There's examples of many famous people like Julius Caesar who had reputations for having affairs with men as well as with women. So in a way, it seems much more sexually liberal, but it also sometimes involves issues of non-consent, which I think we should rightly pay attention to. And again, many, many negative examples coming out of ancient Rome as well as positive ones when we think about diversity.
What about the sort of, I guess, appropriation of ideas from Egypt?
Egypt, Rome had a love affair with Egypt. It was absolutely entranced by Egyptian art, by Egyptian culture, Egyptian religion. So I've talked about the religions that Rome adopted from other places, and one of the most popular ones was the worship of Isis, who is an Egyptian fertility and love goddess. So you find temples to Isis all over Roman towns, even as far away as London, you can find these temples. Egyptian fashion spread rapidly as well, and you will often find in Roman dining rooms there will be whole walls that depict kind of quasi-mystical views of Egypt, where you get to see all these fantastical creatures that lived in Egypt and people. And this is a really interesting example of how the Romans did diversity. If you think about the ancient world, when they didn't have the internet, they didn't have any kind of really fast information communication technology. They really knew the outside world largely through images and through objects and through stories. There weren't really that many maps. There wasn't a ready availability of encyclopedias or other sorts of literate information, and most people weren't literate anyway. So they really understood Egypt a lot through the images that came in to Rome of Egypt. And so it's interesting that this implies that there's a certain tokenizing that happens in Romans' encounters with the other. They are literally putting pressure on there are few representations that they've seen of Egypt to represent the whole complex reality that is out there. And so images, paintings, objects, even people who were maybe imported as slaves or people that you might encounter in the street, those things all came to suffice for a fuller knowledge of the outside world in the Roman imagination. So part of what my book is looking at are places where the Romans did encounter these tokens of faraway lands. And I'm interested in the psychology of how they encountered these tokens and how they use them to reconstruct their construct an understanding of the world around them. And I think a lot of times what they were doing is kind of playing with their own power over others. One of my examples in my book, I look at Roman streets and cityscapes as a place where the Romans encountered diversity. They met a lot of people from all over the empire, but they also were building huge buildings and collecting materials for those buildings that were made out of parts of the empire. So Egypt was a source of all sorts of fabulous stone that was not local to Italy, and many, many other places in empire, Africa, Asia, Greece, all provided materials that would go into the construction of a single building. So if you walked if you walked upon a floor made out of colored marbles from all over the Roman world, you were sort of symbolically treading upon Rome's empire. You were able to participate as a common guy or a common man or a common woman in the street in the project of empire by enjoying some of its fruits in terms of the imported goods that were flowing into the city.
We're going to look at, because I know one of your interests is how we can take sort of lessons from ancient Rome, both a negative and positive, and shed light on our own world. And we're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Don't order the indigenous Latins to change their ancient name, or to become Trojans, or be called Teucrians, or for these men to change their tongue or their clothes. So says Juno in the Aeneid, suggesting that there should be diversity celebrated. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Nandini Pandey. We are talking about diversity in ancient Rome. Can you tell me about that passage?
Yeah, that comes from a bargain that Juno strikes at the end of the epic Aeneid. She has been trying for the whole 12 books of the Aeneid to prevent the Trojans from landing in Italy, where they are destined to found a great new civilization of Rome. And this is the sort of moment where she bargains that the Trojans will only survive and they will only become great if they are able to culturally mix in and blend with the local population. And in a way, that moment opens out it is what triggers the end of the epic. The action is finally allowed to resolve, but it also says a lot about Rome's secret for success. I think that Juno's words about assimilation, the necessity of hybridizing yourself culturally and blending with others, was really the Roman secret for successful expansion and government of lands across three continents. It's because they were able to blend and adapt and not just impose their identities on the people that they governed to the point that they were the people they governed. Seneca actually says at one point that the Roman Senate had once debated a proposition to force slaves to dress differently than free people so that they could be marked out. But the proposition gets rejected because the Senate thought that if everyone could see how numerous the slaves in Rome were, there would immediately be a revolution. What's interesting to me about that phrase is that it shows that there isn't any visible color difference between the enslaved population and the freed population in the city of Rome.
So you have to find a different way to demarcate that.
Yeah, you needed to rely on dress to distinguish people. Although actually a lot of slaves for elite households would probably be a lot better dressed than some of the urban plebs. It's interesting that classics has had a long history with European colonialism. Passages like the Aeneid, works like the Aeneid have often been used to reflect upon, say, the British project of colonizing India and other places around the world. The Aeneid was actually quoted by a British member of parliament named Enoch Powell in an attempt to sort of incite race hatred and to prophesy that there would be some kind of racial bloodshed in the UK. And classical works like the Aeneid or like bits of Roman history constantly are getting appropriated by hate groups and anti-immigration groups as an attempt to their purpose is to warn people that too much racial mixing is terrible. It caused the downfall of Rome, so therefore it could cause the downfall of Europe. These appropriations of the classics in the service of hate they drive me crazy because not only are they evil, but they're actually wrong. They're historically incorrect. They get it exactly the opposite. It was because the Romans were so good at integrating with and intermarrying and providing opportunities to people across empire that they managed to hold on for so long. So what I want to do in this book is try to rewrite the story and make us look at the secrets to Rome's success, as well as learn from the things that they did badly, because I think we can learn a lot from the cheapness of human life in Roman antiquity. I think we can learn what not to do by looking at how the Romans relied on tokens and relied on people who were trafficked and who had no consent in the matter to form their knowledge of the outside world. So one thing that I'm specifically thinking about is we're very familiar with diversity measures in our campuses and across our country. There's ways that we can do diversity better in ways that don't tokenize people and force people to represent their whole race. Often we do diversity in ways that make us feel good when we're at the top. So
look at us being diverse by picking one person out of a group and
that's right.
Showcasing that person.
I mean, there was even a scandal, I think, in the early 2000s at UW where a black person got photoshopped onto
I have seen that. It's an admissions brochure.
That's right.
And they grafted a African-American man's face onto the picture to make it look like he had been at the football game.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing is a kind of commodification of diversity. We put value on looking liberal and looking cosmopolitan, and therefore we often, universities will try to get as many people of color on their front webpage as they possibly can to advertise how multicultural they are. But they don't always do as good a job as they could of supporting the people who actually come from disadvantaged backgrounds or who come from groups that are historically marginalized. And I don't just mean racially, I mean socioeconomically as well, religiously. There's all sorts of forms of diversity that are not immediately visible. So I think that by thinking about how the Romans used humans from all across the world and used goods and objects from all across the world and imported them and got what they wanted from them, that kind of shows us a potential ugly side of diversity when we're using diversity to indulge our own appetites or our desire for sophistication. It shocks me how often when you ask people about their city's diversity, they will almost always the first thing they talk about is the food. So the availability of ethnic food that they want to eat. But they're not always thinking about the families that are making that food or the workers in the kitchen who are probably getting underpaid. We tend to think of diversity really in terms of how we can benefit from it. I think the Romans did a lot of that too. But what they did right that we haven't done as well in our society is there was no assumed correlation between someone's race and their status and their value as a person. And I think in this country, we're still working really hard to get through the terrible legacy of slavery in our country. I don't know if you've seen the New York Times 1619 Project, but there's been I think fascinating and wonderful attempt to sort of reckon with the fact that American prosperity and the story of American success is to a great degree built upon the backs of slaves. I think the Romans were actually kind of more honest about how they used people, and they were also more pragmatic in equipping people once freed to succeed. When slaves were freed in the U.S., basically as a war measure, they weren't given anything to help them out. They didn't have necessarily any financing, any funds, any education, like anything to help them be free citizens and to help them be equal. The Romans actually had really strong networks whereby a master, when he had a slave, would actually, well, first of all, there's this really clever technique where a master would give a slave a sort of nest egg called a peculium, and the slave could therefore gain a little bit of profit from his endeavors and have a little buy-in to the things that he was doing for his master as a slave. Then when he was free, his former master had a continuing relationship with him, and it was a matter of pride and also honor and pragmatic success that the master would set the slave up to succeed, to have a successful business, and then because of various social and economic rules and inheritance laws and things like that, the former slave's success would actually help the master. So slaves, I'm probably getting a little over elaborate here, but freedmen had continuing ties with their masters whereby a freedman's success would enhance the master's prosperity and social standing, and it really helped all the boats rise if a person were free and enfranchised.
So it sounds as if a couple of the things that you think Rome got right, first of all, was to really embrace a kind of diversity, you know, to bring it in, to not try to change other people or make them assimilate, and then also to not link a person's merit to their race or skin color, and also if you had a slave that was freed, you know, to make sure that person succeeded. Is there a danger in glamorizing ancient Rome?
Yes, and I really want to underline that ancient Rome gives us very mixed messages, and this is not a Pollyanna story of happiness and hope necessarily. I mean, I think that the Romans have so much to teach us also in terms of their reliance on violence and their reliance on exploitation. It was actually for incredibly cynical reasons, in part, that the Romans did cultivate diversity so well. So, for instance, you can find the Roman author Varro talks about slaves and has certain stereotypes of which kinds of slaves are better for which tasks. And then he advises masters to try to make sure they have a diverse group of slaves, because he thinks that if you have too many slaves from one area of Rome, they'll start fighting with each other and get into all sorts of quarrels. So he's encouraging you to have a really diverse population of slaves because it helps you as an owner if you can get more work out of these people. That's a really kind of ugly side of diversity, right? Where diversity is actually a tool of empire. In a way, on a larger geopolitical scale, the Romans allowing so much diversity to exist in their various provinces that they ruled, from Britain to Syria and Egypt, all over the world, that was a very pragmatic and cynical tool, right? Because if you allow people to keep their local traditions, and basically you interact with the elites and get the elites to help enforce your power, you have an empire with very little work to do in governing. It's a lot more work to try to force cultural conformity than to let cultures just exist. And remember, this is a sort of era without a lot of technology. It's really hard to move people around. The total Roman army around the age of Augustus was only about maybe a quarter million people in the army, whereas the population of Rome was far, far higher, about 50 million or so. So you had to use sort of soft tools, soft power, and you had to incentivize people to be loyal in order to maintain power. That happens on a state level. But it also happens within households, where the prospect of manumission, if you've behaved well, helps your slaves. That's what incentivizes your slaves not to rebel, not to have that rebellion that Seneca kind of mentions the possibility of, and instead work well for you and please you, and then eventually be freed so that they, as freed citizens, can have children who then will become full citizens and who can then rise through the ranks.
It seems as if ancient Rome was so complicated, you know, with so many different kinds of attitudes, it's hard to reach a conclusion. What if somebody just straight out asks you, so were the ancient Romans racist?
Well, there are certainly a few passages of Roman literature that you can point to as evidence that there was resentment toward newcomers from other cultures. So there's a song during the lifetime of Julius Caesar that says that he conquered the Gauls and then led them into the Senate house. This is really interesting because Julius Caesar did have near genocidal wars against the Gauls, but he also thought that it redounded well on him and it helped him establish his own power in Rome if he enfranchised some of them and enabled them to attain some of the highest political positions in the country.
Kind of a team of rivals?
Maybe something like that. I'm not really familiar with that. But so what happens is there is enough Gauls coming into Rome as senators that people start not telling them, they start refusing to tell them how to get to the Senate House. So the joke is that there's so many Gauls that people in Rome are resentful of their success. But what I take from that story is that the Gauls were able to pretty rapidly go from being enemies of Rome to being senators, right? Almost all of the evidence that you can find for racism in Rome is actually also evidence that people from other places than the city of Rome were doing really well and thriving. The main place that people go to when discussing this question are the satirists, Martial and Juvenal, because you can find these writers of satire complaining about all the Syrians who are coming into Rome and taking all the best jobs and doing really well for themselves while the old native Roman stock are displaced and have to leave the city. That's basically a summary of a poem by Juvenal. But Juvenal, the writer, does not say this in his own voice. He actually has a speaker whose name, Umbricius, literally means something like the overshadowed man or the shady man. And we can tell that this speaker is just really resentful at the success of others. And so it's hard to know what's the object of satire here. Is it the Syrians who are coming into Rome and taking all the good jobs? Or is it the guy who doesn't have tradable professions, who is losing out to this influx of skilled labor coming into Rome? Is he the speaker of the satire, the object of the satire? I want to oppose to that literary side a really strong and powerful tendency within Roman philosophy that says basically that humans are all created equal. It's interesting. This language is really familiar to us from the Declaration of Independence.
Right?
The founding fathers of the U.S. were actually thinking very much of Roman theorists and Roman philosophers when they wrote these ideas down. I would argue that the Romans actually did a better job of putting that philosophy that humans are equal into practice.
So if you just had a few minutes with someone, let's say you're on a plane going somewhere and they want to know kind of just a real short version of what is most important to know about ancient Rome and why are you kind of stuck in the past? What is it that about ancient Rome that fascinates you? What would you say?
I like to see ancient Rome as an estranging mirror when we see ourselves reflected, but in a different form that helps us recognize our own flaws and virtues as a society. So there's so many ways in which ancient Rome is like us. And I find it really tricky as I teach, because I think students have a tendency to sort of over-assimilate themselves to Rome and think that the Romans were just like us. They were not just like us. There are a lot of terrible things that they did. There are a lot of weird and wonderful things that they did. I think it's important to maintain that sense that we are actually quite different from the Romans, but that doesn't mean we can't still learn from them. And one thing that I care about as someone who grew up in an Indian immigrant family and in some ways probably internalized a sense that Western culture was better than my home culture, what I want to do is be a presence in the field who can help us recognize that the ancient Roman world really was incredibly multicultural. It was not white. It does not belong to people who grew up with a European background, but it actually belongs to the whole world because the Romans were really one of the first and most successful world civilizations. And I want to help people who grew up like me or who look like me to feel that they, too, can get something from Rome in its similarity, but also its distance from ourselves. It's a form of time travel that allows us to travel huge imaginative distances and I think helps us really understand our own place and our own multicultural society better.
That's terrific. I'm Emily Auerbach, and my guest has been Nandini Pandey. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much.
This is University of the Air on Wisconsin Public Radio.